Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Millions of businesses across the EU's 27 member states remain closed due to COVID-19. Retail, hospitality and aviation sectors have been decimated by the pandemic.
People who never were really in the risk of poverty are now really at the risk of poverty. They are now queuing up for food aids.
The European Commission has just published its EU Economic Semester Report 2021, and things are not looking good.
We will have an incomplete and uneven recovery over the coming 2 years, and with persistent uncertainty and multiple risks.
The Commission's report highlights how a debt mountain is growing in the EU, particularly in key nations such as Italy and France. Lobby groups are questioning whether financial support packages already announced will be sufficient.
Is it going to start a new growth for Europe and employment for Europe? We are not sure either. So it's a lot of promise. They have to deliver, because otherwise people will be so disappointed and the trust will completely disappear.
The EU is experiencing its sharpest ever decline in employment due to the pandemic, and things were certainly not perfect even before COVID-19. The European Commission says political leaders across the bloc must take decisive action to prevent social catastrophe.
We need a quick agreement on all elements of EU's €1.82 trillion recovery package to support the real economy. People and businesses are waiting.
The EU Commission says 4.1 million temporary jobs have been lost in the bloc. Young adults have been impacted most severely.
Suicide rates in the EU are on the up. Therefore, social rights groups say the need for governments to agree on financial support is not just about the economy. It is, in fact, a matter of life and death. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are rapidly rising in the Gaza Strip, with nearly 500 cases being discovered on a daily basis. On Wednesday, 4 deaths were reported and 600 infections were detected, bringing the number of infections to over 12,000. Hospitals in Gaza, meanwhile, are running low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. During a press conference, the Ministry of Interior in Gaza raised the alarm over the rising number of infections.
The Ministry of Interior may be forced to take some extreme and tough measures, including a full lockdown given the high number of daily infections. Today, the rate of infections has increased more than 20% compared with only 5% during the first weeks of the spread of the deadly virus.
Due to the Israeli blockade, nearly 2 million Gazans are under terrible strain, and their worries over the coronavirus have been heavily compounded.
The rapid rise in the number of infections is frightening. Given the current circumstances, we are praying for a miracle to keep us safe during this deadly pandemic.
The blockade has destroyed our economy, and a full lockdown will be catastrophic. I think a partial lockdown is better so that people can make a living amid the dire economic situation.
The coronavirus spread among the general population has taken its toll on the impoverished coastal sliver. A full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip in late August for a period of 2 weeks, after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
During the full lockdown, factories and businesses were completely closed, inflicting a heavy blow on the economic sector of the enclave, which has been battered by the Israeli blockade. All institutions, including civil society organizations, are suffering from lack of funding as poverty and unemployment rates increasing rapidly.
The coronavirus continues to threaten the socio-economic welfare of Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as coronavirus infections continue to increase at a fast pace amid the crippling Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A latest report by the Italian Pediatrics Society has highlighted that 12% of COVID-19 infections, or 126,000 cases, regarded children or teenagers. The study, based on monitoring data from the Higher Health Institute, has found that over 36,000 were under 10, while around 90,000 were in the 10 to 19 age group. The report stressed that the fatality rate was extremely low and that the vast majority only manifested minor clinical forms of COVID-19.
A study carried out by Rome's University of La Sapienza has found that in some Italian regions, the number of infant deaths at birth tripled during the lockdown months. This is due to the fact that most health checks were cancelled or postponed.
The most likely reason behind this is that many mothers-to-be did not attend medical checks for fears of being infected with COVID-19. We monitored the number of newborns in all Lazio's region's hospitals in March, April and May, and we noted a new significant drop compared to the same period last year.
The study has also found that the number of premature newborns went down considerably during the lockdown months compared to the year before.
This is a positive data point which has to be associated to the fact that mothers-to-be were in mandatory time off due to the COVID-19 restrictions. The most important message from this report is that pregnant women must continue to attend medical checks to prevent neonatal complications.
Meanwhile, Italy's hospitals are facing overwhelming pressure from the coronavirus pandemic. Health authorities fear that there will be more COVID-19 patients in need of intensive care by the last week of November than during the spring peak. Max Civili, Rome.
Austria goes into its second hard lockdown, with all shops, hotels, bars, restaurants and schools for older children closed until the 6th of December. The curfew that was in place for the past few weeks during the night will now be extended through the day. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz announced that Austria will conduct mass testing in December, using neighbouring Slovakia as its model, in an attempt to save Christmas and guarantee the safe reopening of schools.
In the next few weeks, the government plans to order millions of antigen tests. We want to be able to test the population at the time of reopening. In this way, many asymptomatic people will be discovered and isolated.
Austria's health minister has appealed to the people to use the Stop Corona app, developed by the Austrian Red Cross, to help identify chains of infection and break them. Through this app, users create what's known as digital handshakes. When a user is infected, they can activate an alert message, and people who are in contact with the infected person will be notified automatically.
Based on forecasts, on average there will be 7,000 new infections per day this week. That is too high. Everyone can contribute to prevent the overloading of the health system. We have a limited capacity in the intensive care units. We need to significantly decrease the current influx.
The government has come under criticism for weak contact tracing. The opposition says mass testing would only make sense if it can be repeated regularly.
Vaccination will be the game changer, Sebastian Kurz says, and he suggested it can begin gradually in the first quarter of 2021, with health workers and vulnerable groups getting it first. For now, people are being warned every contact is one too many. Homolisky, Vienna.
With Christmas right around the corner, retailers can only hope and pray the November lockdown is not extended beyond December 2nd. After the severe blow dealt it by the first lockdown, the British economy bounced back by 15.5% in the July to September period. But the worry is that it will shrink again over the winter months. Weak household spending is being blamed for the UK's poor GDP performances.
The unemployment rate in the UK is continuing to surge, and redundancy rates are at an all-time high. Millions of Britons are struggling to make ends meet, and millions more are saving their pennies for even rainier days.
I'm quite happy with what the Chancellor has done. Of course, everybody is. And everybody won't be when they talk about how to get those monies back. I mean, he's talked about cutting duty-free. People are complaining about that.
Concerned, very concerned about younger people in particular because of unemployment, because of the huge debt there's going to be. It's massive, massive worry. And I don't think we've seen how bad it's going to be yet.
Yeah. I think the situation with Brexit is complete shambles. You know, this seems the government doesn't seem to have a grip on it, just as it doesn't seem to have a grip on the COVID epidemic. I mean, it's terribly worrying. I mean, I've got two sons, both who work in hospitality, and they're worried stiff about what's going to happen.
The extension of the furlough scheme might help encourage spending. The government will now be paying 80% of the salaries of workers retained by firms rather than fired until March. Britain's manufacturing sector will be getting a massive tax break extension as well. But according to the Bank of England, things will get worse before they get better. It predicts the UK's GDP could shrink by 2% in the October-December quarter, and its economy is likely to shrink by a record 11% in 2020, before growing by just 7% in 2021. But did the UK have this coming despite COVID-19?
The present situation started a year ago, last September, when the banks began to refuse to lend money to each other, and there was a panic in the banking system. Now, that is always the first sign of a coming huge economic collapse. It always happens about a year or two before the actual collapse. The debt levels have built up to be completely unrepayable. The rich-poor division has increased, and the type of jobs coming into existence due to the technological shift are now temporary and part-time.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, Lee Kane, has quit, and now his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has left as well. Some say this will make for smoother Brexit talks, due to resume this week before an EU summit on Thursday. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively, while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and the large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them. And which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Arrogance utilizes science and technology to exercise its taghuti power.
Pharaoh used to say, "Does not the dominion of Egypt belong to me?" The Holy Quran, chapter 43, verse 51. Very well, he could do whatever he wished in the dominion of Egypt. However, today, the U.S., which is like Pharaoh in those days, not satisfied with the country of the United States. He does not say, "Does not the dominion of Egypt belong to me?" Rather, he embarks on transgressing against other countries. He wages wars, occupies countries, and sets up military bases there. Today, things are like this. What global taghuts do by utilizing human science and technology, resulting in discrimination, inequality, and warmongering, is more serious than ever. The Holy Prophet really grieves him that you should perish. The blessed soul of the Holy Prophet really suffers from humanity's pain in the present time. He is anxious for humanity to achieve bliss, and he wishes to guide humanity. Like a gentle father, in the true sense of the word, he wants humanity to achieve bliss, to be directed to the straight path, and to achieve an end that will be good for it.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger among
There is a point in this holy ayah. It exists at the end of Surah Al-Bara'ah, a surah of war, of expressing one's hatred of the kuffar, and of commanding people to fight and the like. However, at the end of the surah, God says, "It grieves him that you should perish." As we said, this is addressed to the entire humanity. One can derive an important point from this ayah. The ayahs preceding this one do not address ignorant non-Muslims. Rather, they address the leaders of kuffar and the chiefs of arrogance. They address the apparatus of power that has dominated the fate of human societies.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Hello and warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. The U.S. top diplomat is visiting Israeli settlements that are all regarded to be illegal based on international law. Mike Pompeo is the first American Secretary of State visiting the illegal settlements. The trip is considered to be provocative, something that even previous U.S. administrations went to length to avoid. Pompeo also broke the ground by visiting the Syrian Golan Heights that's been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The trip has drawn the ire of the Palestinians. How significant is the controversial visit at this point in time, and what is it trying to achieve? Stay with us for a debate on that.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has been projected the winner in the disputed U.S. presidential vote. That means in about 2 months, Donald Trump will have to hand in power to Biden. His administration, however, is using every opportunity to take controversial steps. On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid a visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to further consolidate Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands.
During the Trump administration, America stands with Israel like never before. Indeed, the commitment we've made, the ironclad commitment we've made to the Jewish state, will continue.
Pompeo said the U.S. will label the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign as anti-Semitic and cancerous. He said Washington will require that imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank be labeled as made in Israel. In 2016, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution to reaffirm the illegality of Israeli settlements. Referring to Israelis as an occupying power, the resolution called on Israel to stop settlement constructions and abide by its obligations under international law. Later in the day, Mike Pompeo also visited the occupied Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in a 1967 war. President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the region last year. Pompeo's Thursday visits drew the ire of the Palestinians. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed the U.S. labeling move as a violation of international law. Also, senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Wassel Abu Youssef, said Pompeo's labeling announcement, quote, reaffirms the partnership between U.S. President Trump and the occupation. Another senior PLO member, Hanan Ashrawi, said Mike Pompeo's visit is aimed at setting another illegal precedent. Pompeo's visits to an Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights were controversial enough. However, they are dwarfed by other anti-Palestinian moves taken by the Trump administration in the past 4 years. Trump announced Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Palestinians say the city belongs to them and is the capital of their state. Trump also relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to al-Quds. The American president also showed unprecedented support for Israeli crimes, including bombardment of the Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Well, let me talk about my report in there. Author and journalist DeMarco Glenn is joining us from California. Political analyst Michael Lane is also joining us from Washington, D.C. Good to have both of you gentlemen on the show. Let's go to Mark in California. Pompeo is the first American top diplomat visiting Israeli settlements that are illegal by the UN resolutions. What message does the U.S. try to relay?
Well, I think we have to look at this in terms of the timing of it all, especially here in the United States in the midst of this contested election. We don't know which way this is going to go. And so I think that the president, through his Secretary of State, is trying to hammer out what he may fear are his last diplomatic steps of his administration. At the very least, what it shows is that Trump is intent, as he promised 4 years ago when he was just a candidate, that he is going to come to some sort of practical and workable resolution to the situation that will at least, even if it does not bring justice to the Palestinians and to the Syrians and the other peoples of the region who have been brutalized by this this mad dog, that at the very least that it would offer America at least the means of extricating itself from what has become an extremely dangerous situation to her personally. All we have to do is take into account the extreme cost that the United States has paid as a result of its incestuous and dirty relationship with Israel in terms of the first Gulf War 30 years ago, and then, of course, the exacerbation of that situation under George W. Bush and what has gone on now with the Arab Spring and everything else. And Trump really would just like to see the United States divorce itself from any more costly engagements in terms of American blood and American treasury.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, there are people and pundits in the United States who are against the U.S. blind support for Tel Aviv, arguing that this support is a liability for the United States. Your take on that?
Well, as we look forward, it's problematic whether Donald Trump is going to be able to spend four more years carrying out his foreign policy in the Middle East as opposed to Joe Biden altering whatever courses he may be inclined to alter as we do that. There's no doubt that Donald Trump has been a strong ally, supporter, and friend, not only of the State of Israel, but personally of Prime Minister Netanyahu. And that has been reflected in the policies, not only vis-a-vis Israel, things that he took, such as the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital, the moving of the United States Embassy, the recognition of the annexation of the Golan, the recognition of some of the settlements in the West Bank being legal, et cetera. But, you know, other thing. I mean, Trump has just been really all in terms of that friendship with the United States and Israel. As we look forward, or not as we look forward, hang on a second on that. So what is Pompeo doing over there today? Well, as we've discussed several times, and as I've opined on this program several times, the United States participation in the JCPOA was not really the United States. Obama did not have the authority to commit the United States to that without a treaty and ratification by the Senate. It was just the policy of the Obama administration. The same thing is true here. Many of these things that President Trump has done are policies of the Trump administration. They are not things that lock and bind his successors into following those particular policies. So I think the reason and the objective, really, of the Pompeo visit here is not just a victory tour around Israel to say, okay, this is what we've done, fond farewell, because they haven't tossed in the towel on the election yet. But this is really an attempt, should Joe Biden be inaugurated in January as President of the United States, he's doing his best to create an environment where Biden will have an extraordinarily difficult time reversing his policies in the Middle East as he was able to reverse some of Obama's policies.
Now, Mark, the United Nations and the international community both calling the Israeli settlement expansion illegal. What makes Washington disregard this and even give it its seal of approval?
I think with Trump, if I can be so bold as to crawl into his head and divine what I think he's trying to do, I think what it is that Trump has recognized that ever since 1967, that all of this debate within the United Nations and, you know, people throwing up the argument of international law, that it really has done nothing. All that it has done is to create a bunch of noise pollution that has given Israel the green light to keep gobbling up more Palestinian land. And I think that Trump, being the very shrewd and astute businessman that that he is, he understands that what has to be done is to do an end run around this, an end run around the United Nations, and to just establish that certain facts on the ground do exist, and then use those as the launching point for a new paradigm in terms of coming to some resolution to this problem. And we have to remember as well, you know, as much as we obviously we want to fall back on the legality of the United Nations resolutions, the fact of the matter is that the United Nations was the one responsible for creating this mess in the first place. It was the United Nations that recognized Israel, that recognized this occupation within historic Palestine. And so I would counsel my friends around the world who like to fall back on what appears to be the legal strength of United Nations resolutions that, you know, the United Nations has done nothing except to facilitate this problem and in many cases just to make it worse.
Michael, what does Pompeo's Golan Heights visit indicate? I mean, is legitimizing the Israeli occupation of the Syrian land what the U.S. is trying to do?
First, let me say I agree with about 99.5% of what my colleague just said on that. Really sort of spot-on analysis. But so what is Pompeo doing in the Golan? Mm-hmm. Well, in Israel's mind, and indeed probably in much of the United States government mind, Israel was really never going to give back the Golan. It was just strategically, as a military piece of terrain, much too important for them to abandon without certain assurances that they were never going to get. So they stayed there and occupied since 1967, and ultimately a short time ago decided they were going to formally annex the land. And it was only just last year, in fact, that President Trump, on behalf of the United States, or you might argue on behalf of his administration, said that they were going to recognize that particular annexation, and the Golan is now no longer occupied territory in the eyes of the Trump administration. It is now part of Israel. Pompeo was there to underscore that this has been the policy of the Trump administration for about a year and a half, maybe just a couple months longer than that. And to create an awareness and to create a sort of aura of success over the recognition of that annexation to the point where on the international stage in 2 months or 3 months or whenever Biden gets around to reevaluating and reassessing what's going on there, he finds it more difficult to reverse that U.S. policy than he otherwise might. Now, let me say, I think that Joe Biden has his own ideas. He's been around for 47 years in American government. He has a particular deep loathing, not only for President Trump, but for his policies. And he's unlikely to be pressured or dissuaded from making his own independent evaluations and decisions as to how he's going to pursue Middle East policy as well as anything else that he does so from the Oval Office. But this is really what Pompeo is all about. He's trying to highlight potentially on the Trump administration's way out the door that this is a success of the Trump administration and see if he can make it more of an enduring and lasting legacy of the Trump administration than something that can be easily reversed.
Now, Mark, U.S. Secretary of State has called the global pro-Palestine BDS movement, I'm quoting him, a cancer and anti-Semitic. So how come the U.S. is equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism? They're two totally different issues, as you know. Is Washington trying to silence or, let's say, criminalize anti-Zionism?
No, I think that what Trump is very astutely doing, as I said before, he is a businessman and he knows the importance of the art of the deal and of selling. And he knows that in order to maintain the support that he has in Israel, where he is at least within the people themselves, the right-wing element there, he's very popular. Although, as far as organized Jewish groups in this country go, he's extremely unpopular. And so simply by labeling BDS as being anti-Semitic, these are easy points to score for him, and especially given the fact that, as we're discussing here, Pompeo is in Israel. And this is just Trump's way of establishing or reestablishing, reminding people of his bona fides on this issue. And I think that it's important for us to keep in mind that, you know, while Pompeo is there and shaking hands with Netanyahu and they're smiling and all the rest of that, We're not privy to the kinds of possibly heated discussions that are taking place behind closed doors when the mics and the camera are off. We know that President Trump, back when he was candidate Trump, that he had made it a very strong part of his promised presidency that he was going to come to a peace deal in the Middle East that was going to, at least in a rudimentary way, was going to open the door for the Americans to get out as gracefully as possible from this mess. But he's only partly finished. Okay, so he's given Israel the Golan Heights. He's recognized, you know, Jerusalem, moved the embassy, and he's achieved recognition on the part of these Gulf Arab countries. But the big thing here, obviously, is settling the Palestinian issue, which means, according to Trump's plans, giving the Palestinians 70% of the West Bank, which is wildly, wildly unpopular within the Israeli political class. Now, we may not see this. We may not see the video footage of Netanyahu kicking a hole in the wall or pounding his fist on the desk referencing this. But all can be rest assured that there are discussions taking place right now between Pompeo and Netanyahu that are not as cordial as the video footage that we are seeing right now, and that I would speculate that this the next part of this peace deal that Trump wants to push forward probably represents the main bulk of the conversation that's going on, to which the rest of us are simply not privy.
Now, Michael, a U.S.-based human rights watchdog argues that rather than fighting systemic racism and far-right extremism in the United States, the Trump administration is undermining common fight against anti-Semitism by falsely equating it with peaceful support for boycotting Israel. Your comment.
You know, labeling BDS an anti-Semitic program is something that predates Donald Trump by quite a bit. This has been sort of mainstream thought and mainstream rhetoric in the United States, and there are exceptions and very, very high-profile, visible exceptions. But it has been rhetoric that has been used commonplace in the United States for more than a decade. So Trump is not really turning over new ground here. He's not setting a new precedent, a new policy. In fact, if I read the State Department's release correctly, what is new here is not the idea that BDS is an anti-Semitic thing, but that it is being officially labeled as such by the State Department on behalf of the United States government. It has always been part of the United States bipartisan support for Israel to condemn BDS. I don't think that that he is necessarily saying anybody who wants to internally in the United States argue that BDS is not anti-Semitic necessarily castigates them as an anti-Semitic person or having an anti-Semitic argument, but it was more towards countries and organizations that are advocating it and things like that, and so those organizations that are in the forefront vocally and active-wise in terms of promoting BDS are likely to be excluded from certain privileges of the United States as a result of that. How much of that can be done in the next 60 days, I don't know. They probably aren't organizations that got a lot of federal contracts from the United States or other things anyway. But again, it's one more thing that has been announced very high profile with the attempt to make it very difficult for Joe Biden to undo that, should he choose to do so. Okay. I think Biden's pretty much been on board with that idea, though, that BDS is a really, really bad idea.
Okay, we're running out of time. I got one question for both of you gentlemen. What options are Palestinians left with, Mark, as the U.S. is keeping its blind and biased support for Israel? What can they do to redeem their rights and liberate their land? 1 minute, please.
Well, I think that all they can really do is stay the course and plead their case before the world, hoping that enough people of goodwill in the world will understand the horrible injustices that have been dumped on millions of innocent people. But at the same time, I do think that they have to develop a certain level of practicality in all of this and understand that, the American system you know, we like to champion ourselves as being the land of the free and the home of the brave, but when it comes to our political system, it is every bit as much Israeli-occupied territory as is historic Palestine. And so the Palestinians, okay, I think, are going to have to be very practical about this.
Mike, your comments briefly, please.
Yeah, very briefly. So when President Trump unveiled, rolled out, imposed, whatever word you want to use, his deal of the century, and still had gone at that point close to 2 years without President Abbas returning his phone calls or those of his representatives or a meeting or anything like that, Trump was very careful to say that, okay, so there's going to be a four-year window here. The clock starts ticking now. We're going to keep this open for further discussions with the Palestinians to make sure that their input is received and that we can accommodate as many of their needs and wants as we possibly can. So a lot of that four-year window or a little bit of that four-year window has already ticked by. Clearly, Abbas is waiting for a new presidency to be established in the United States before he makes up his mind if he's going to engage on that. But I would suggest to the Palestinians that engaging with whoever is president of the United States sooner rather than later will preserve some of their things, because the more the reality gets locked in stone, the less likely they are to be able to maneuver and change some of that.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Author and journalist Mark Glenn joined me from California, and political analyst Michael Lane from Washington, D.C. Top media host, Behrouz Najafian. I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has said that Senator Lindsey Graham asked whether it was possible to invalidate legally cast ballots after President Donald Trump was narrowly defeated in the state. In an interview with the Washington Post, Raffensperger said Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, questioned him about the Senate's signature-matching law and asked whether political bias might have played a role in counties where poll workers accepted higher rates of mismatched signatures. According to Raffensperger, Lindsey Graham then asked whether he had the authority to toss out all mail-in ballots in these counties. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Georgia Secretary of State Says Lindsey Graham Suggested He Throw Out Legal Ballots. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino's article. The Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has said that Senator Lindsey Graham asked whether it was possible to invalidate legally cast ballots after President Donald Trump was narrowly defeated in the state. In an interview with the Washington Post, Raffensperger said Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, questioned him about the state's signature-matching law and asked whether political bias might have played a role in counties where poll workers accepted higher rates of mismatched signatures. According to Raffensperger, Lindsey Graham then asked whether he had the authority to toss out all mail-in ballots in these counties. Raffensperger was reportedly stunned by the question, in which Senator Graham appeared to suggest that he find a way to throw out legally cast absentee ballots. It sure looked like it was wanting to go down that road, he said. Lindsey Graham confirmed the conversation to reporters on Capitol Hill, but said it was ridiculous to suggest that he pressured Raffensperger to throw out legally cast absentee ballots. According to Lindsey Graham, he only wanted to learn more about the process for verifying signatures, because what happens in Georgia affects the whole nation. I thought it was a good conversation, Graham said on Monday, 16th of November, after the interview was published. I'm surprised to hear he characterized it that way. President Donald Trump has refused to accept results showing Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, falsely blaming rampant fraud and irregularities that election officials in both parties have dismissed as meritless. Georgia, a reliably Republican state with 16 electoral votes, is currently conducting a hand recount of roughly 5 million presidential ballots, which is expected to be completed by 20th of November. Joe Biden led in the state by about 14,000 votes after the initial tally. This comes as Brad Raffensperger faces mounting backlash from his own Republican Party after defending the state's electoral process. The state's two Republican senators, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, both locked in tight runoff elections to keep their seats, have called for Raffensperger's resignation, calls that Raffensperger has dismissed. Congressman Doug Collins of Georgia, who is spearheading the president's effort to prove fraud in the state, has also been critical of Raffensperger, accusing him of siding with Democrats because he refused to endorse the false claim that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. In an interview, Brad Raffensperger called Collins, who has not contested the result of the special election race he lost to Kelly Loeffler, a liar and a charlatan. Raffensperger said every accusation of voter fraud would be thoroughly vetted, but there was currently no credible evidence that wrongdoing had occurred on a large enough scale to affect the outcome of the election. He also told the Washington Post that the recount would affirm the results of the initial count and prove the accuracy of the Dominion voting machines, which Donald Trump has falsely claimed deleted votes cast for him. Voting rights and ethics groups condemned Lindsey Graham's comments, and some called for his resignation as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Not only is it wrong for Senator Graham to apparently contemplate illegal behavior, but his suggestion undermines the integrity of our elections and the faith of the American people in our democracy, said Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. In a statement, Noah Bookbinder said, under the guise of rooting out election fraud, it looks like Lindsey Graham is suggesting committing it.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.